To put this in context, if you charge up all 1,576 stairs from the ground floor to the observation deck of the Empire State Building, your muscles will burn only 54 calories, which is roughly the equivalent of a single Oreo cookie. That is not to say that going up all those flights of stairs won't burn calories, but most of the additional energy actually stems from increased circulation and heart rate. If you can turn down even a few of the brain's higher functions, you will see a vast improvement in your ability to hold your breath. And there is no better tool to dissect and modulate the inner workings of the mind than meditation. People have been meditating for thousands of years. The very earliest written descriptions of meditation emerged in India almost 3,500 years ago. Oral traditions extend even further back. Yogis, monks, and spiritual seekers have developed hundreds, if not thousands, of meditative techniques aimed at probing the very innermost corners of the mind. The most basic, and some might argue most important, goal of meditation is simply to calm the mind and stem the ceaseless stream of thoughts that we have all day. It is possible to adapt just about any meditative practice that you might have with the Wim Hof method. But the easiest ones tend to focus on visualizations. Visualization meditation. Even the blackest blackness behind your eyelids hides an array of colors and shapes. While there are centuries of explanations of what the shapes mean, or indeed if they mean anything at all, one thing we can be sure of is that when you close your eyes, you still process information. This meditation aims to focus your thoughts so that your mind does not wander. Your mind will use less energy if it can focus on only one thing, and will allow you to go deeper into the physical experience of meditation. Start by closing your eyes. Clear away any thoughts or mental clutter from your day. Don't muse over the bills you have to pay, the conversation at the office water cooler, or what a friend said the other day. Just sit in one place and try to be in the moment. Notice that you might be able to make out shapes in the blackness. Perhaps you see small flecks of reds, blues, and greens, or maybe there's a blotch of color floating out in space. If you don't see anything, don't worry about it. Just look at the blackness itself. But maybe it looks as if there are electric currents in the play of lights. Notice the outlines of shapes and try to sense how deep the space in front of you really is. Is it a shallow blackness that stops at your eyelids? Or is it a deep and spacious void? Simply observe the character of what you see. If you start to think about other things, let them go, and gently guide your focus back to just looking at the shapes that you see. Imagine that some of those shapes are actually light, and try to feel that light enter your body. Let the light come in through your eyes or through your forehead, and let it flow down your spine and out to your fingers and to your toes. Keep focusing on the movement of the colors. And now, start the power breathing. Take 30 breaths while focusing on the light and as you begin to hold your breath. Now, notice how your body feels. Are you dizzy? Do your fingers or toes itch? Are you cold or hot? Feel your body and imagine that the light you can see stretches all the way to your toes and that it is actually air. Imagine that you're filling your body with light and with air as you hold your breath. Then, as holding back from breathing starts to get difficult, start to clench your muscles from your toes upwards and think that you are pushing that air up to your head. notice how it feels. And when you have to breathe, do it. Repeat this cycle of visualization until you can hold your breath for at least 3 minutes. There are many explanations of what happens during meditation visualizations. Monks, yogis, and Chinese meditation practitioners say that the colors correspond to a system of spinning chakras, wheel-like torrents of energy that make up a human's spiritual anatomy. Others argue that the colors indicate metabolic functions of specific organs. Most scientists say that there is no proof that the shapes a person sees are anything more than just meaningless static of the brain. Whatever the truth of the matter is, visualizations are real experiences. When you give yourself a way to connect the visual information behind your eyes to the sensations in your extremities, you have unlocked a tool for taking control of the process of the immune system itself. The combination of breathing exercises, muscle flexing, and visualization are the basic core exercises of Wim Hof's training. But meditation and breathing practice alone only comprise half the equation. While these activities can prime the nervous system for ceding some control to the conscious mind, in order to make real progress, you need to use the environment to trigger an autonomic response that you usually have no ability to access on your own. Getting cold. The first time that you try to stand in the snow, it's not only going to feel cold, it's going to hurt. Even though it won't hurt any more than, say, a 5-mile run or hitting the gym to lift weights if you're severely out of shape, the sense of fear that comes from the cold reaches down into some dark, primordial core inside of all of us. The mere thought of it makes most people cringe. Your brain is probably screaming, "Hell no!" If you urge your friends to try it, their responses will resemble the various stages of grief: denial that it's a good idea, anger that you even suggested it, bargaining for some other exercise option, depression, okay, maybe not this one, and finally acceptance that it probably won't kill them. Almost everyone claims that while some people are able to stand in the snow, they themselves are especially vulnerable to the cold. The fact that this is a near universal response might persuade them. And perhaps, if you persevere, they might try it. There is nothing special to the technique. You can fill a bucket or bathtub with ice and jump in. You can turn the shower on as cold as it gets and soak for a minute. Or perhaps the closest to what our ancestors faced, wait for it to snow and then walk outside in nothing but shorts. Whatever the cold source, the goal is to give your system a little shock. Don't ease yourself into the frigid waters and wait for your body to acclimatize. Jump right in and see how your body responds, like you're doing the polar bear plunge. Start maybe with taking 30-second cold showers, and build up from there. The immediate sensations are rarely pleasant. You'll start breathing fast, your pupils will dilate, and you'll want to start moving just to keep yourself warm. Feet in the snow will often turn red as blood courses through the veins before they turn a lighter color when vasoconstriction sets in. While you're in this moment of shock and pain, you have two basic goals. First, you need to control your breathing and keep calm. The sensations that most closely match the feeling of burning will dissipate if you focus your mind on the pain. Try to relax instead of tightly clenching up every muscle. Enduring the snow is the same exact mental trick as trying to delay a sneeze or resist being ticklish. Once you feel reasonably calm, the second thing that you need to master is suppressing your impulse to shiver. After the initial shock of the cold recedes, your body will soon click on an instinctual program to warm itself through muscle movement. It is up to you to keep that at bay. Shivering will certainly use up a lot of calories, and for this reason, it can be useful if you want to lose weight. But your goal here is to command your nervous system to submit to your will. If your body can't shiver itself warm again or rely on the insulating properties of your white fat, its only remaining option is to start ramping up your metabolism. This is to say, you will begin passively generating brown fat and building up your stores of mitochondria if you can suppress your response to shiver. The first time you experience the cold will be the worst. Every nerve will fire like it's raw and has never been used before. Your heart will race, and you'll want to do anything you can to retreat into warmth. Unless you are in cold weather where frostbite is likely, you're not really in any serious danger, even though your mind will tell you that you are. The veins in your hands will clench with the force that it reserves for severing a limb. If you are jumping into a cold body of water, go with a friend, just in case one of you runs into trouble. Nonetheless, if you last just 5 minutes, your entire body will probably be screaming for relief. Go inside and warm up. Most likely, the sensation of vasodilation, when the veins loosen and let warm blood back inside, will hurt even more. For some, the process of rewarming is more painful than the initial exposure. Think of the pain as a sort of baptism. When you try it again the next day, it will be much more manageable. Of course, not everyone has access to cold on demand. If you live in a temperate climate or are in the throes of summer, then you may have difficulty finding a reliable source of icy water. A lot of this is going to be up to your own ingenuity. Maybe you just take cold showers, turn the knob as low as it will go, and let the cold water cascade over your head, back, chest, and legs. Or maybe you can spend an inordinate amount of time in the freezer section of your grocery store. Perhaps you fill up a bathtub with ice. One person I know who lives in the Caribbean devised a shower head out of a bucket of ice that slowly drips ice water onto his head. Another thing you can do is simply turn down the thermostat to below 66 degrees in the winter. That's the temperature that most people will feel the need to shiver if they aren't moving around too much. By simply keeping the ambient air temperature that low, and not wearing a lot of layers to insulate yourself from it, you will force your body to adopt a different strategy to stay warm. Whatever you end up doing, you need to get to a place where your ordinary response would be to start shivering, and then do everything you can to resist the temptation. Active conditioning. Another very simple technique is what I call active conditioning. This is where you start whatever workout you would normally do in one environmental extreme or another. I will often go out running in just shorts and sneakers during the middle of winter when snow blankets the Colorado landscape. I do a 3-mile run around a lake near my house without a shirt on, while other brave souls are clad head to toe in fleece. Heads turn, and most people will think that I'm crazy. But anyone who has even a modest running habit knows that once they get moving, their core temperature spikes upward. Those fleece-clad joggers are probably boiling up. However, since the nerves in your skin can still detect the weather, outdoor exercise in the cold while shirtless will send the appropriate signals to start generating brown fat. Shirtless runs end up being one of the most comfortable ways to practice the Wim Hof method. If it's really cold, it's not cheating to wear a hat or gloves to ward off frostbite in the extremities. The same thing goes for hot weather. When the mercury in the thermometer rockets upward, do a run in the middle of the noonday heat. Don't push yourself so hard that you pass out from heat stroke, but get used to a slightly uncomfortable temperature. You can do the same thing in any weather, be it rain or shine. Part of the reason humans have gotten weaker as we've insulated ourselves with technology is because we don't experience variety in our daily lives. Make yourself a little uncomfortable, and all of a sudden you might discover that it isn't nearly as bad as you imagined that it might be. One more thing. Remember to wear sunscreen. Brown fat activation. It seems to take about a week of training before your body recruits enough brown fat for it to have a meaningful impact on your metabolism. If you don't live in a cold climate, it is more than likely that you are going to start out with near zero BAT. Over time, however, your stores will grow, and that brown fat will passively suck out white fat from your bloodstream and burn it for body heat. However, there are moments when you might want more than just a little heat over a long period of time. What if you want to get warm right now? After a few weeks of training, you can make BAT activate on command. The process for doing it is a familiar one. Once you're already cold, clench the muscles in your feet and hands, and then sequentially tighten every muscle above them. The method is essentially the same as the one you use during power breathing, except now, rather than simply pushing all the blood up to your head in general, you instead focus on a specific point on the small ridge of the backside of your skull where the temporal bone and the occipital bone meet, just behind your ears. Once you've pushed all of your muscles up to that point, then you squinch any muscles you have in your scalp and head and pressure downward to the same spot. Essentially, you're trying to pinch this area with muscle contractions. This is a somewhat advanced technique, and the pressure could make a person pass out, so don't force it. And also, remember what happened to Wim in the sauna in Poland. Definitely don't try this method when you're in a hot place. While it doesn't seem to work for everyone, many people will feel an intense burst of heat. For me, it sometimes arcs down my neck and into the area between my shoulder blades. Other people describe it as a fuse burning through their body. Either way, get ready for a lot of heat. A 15-minute daily workout. My daily routine mixes elements of all of these practices, plus a few more that I borrowed from a local yoga class. I always start out before breakfast, when my circulatory system is the most active and hasn't yet been weighted down by the process of digestion. I begin with 3 rounds of power breathing, followed by a breath hold with no air in my lungs. I time myself and try to add 1 minute to each breath hold until I hit 3 minutes. Then I do another round of breathing, followed by 50 breath-out push-ups. I follow this with a headstand for 30 seconds to let the blood move to my head. I usually start my shower warm, but finish with at least 1 minute of cold water. I get out feeling refreshed and pumped full of endorphins. On top of that, I do some kind of cardio exercise outside about 3 times a week. Altogether, it isn't very time-consuming. It's also pretty much all that I will do to prepare myself for the coming challenges. Chapter 5. BIB 2182. Sometime in the middle of July 2015, I take a drive into the Rocky Mountains to a ski resort that has a strategy to remain relevant during its off-season. Outside the base station, there are 12 merchants hawking athletic apparel, heart rate monitoring systems, sneakers, and t-shirts. A few thousand people mill around the lodge, sipping beer, chewing on cardboard-flavored energy bars, and waiting for their designated starting heat in an athletic event that is both totally mainstream and fairly new to American sports. Just above the parking lot where I am standing, a series of rope ladders, mud crawls, water barriers, and God knows what else are waiting for the masses to defeat them. The obstacle course, this one called a Spartan race, is supposed to push me to the very limits of my mental and physical endurance. The race coordinators promise that I will suffer over the course of a few hours, and become a better man for it. For some reason, this sounds like fun. So when I report to the registration tent with my wife, who enthusiastically said yes to the idea of participating, a 20-something woman gives us two small packets of Vital Racing paraphernalia and crosses off our names from a printed list. In my envelope is a radio frequency identification chip, or RFID chip, that I will need to wear in order to track my time over the course, a headband with my bib number, and a voucher for a free beer when it's all over. There is also a waiver to sign so that we can get past the gatekeeper. The most important part of the document stands out in bold red type, so that those entering into the agreement will have no legitimate excuse to argue that they didn't see it just in case they decide to lawyer up sometime down the road. It reads, "There is a real possibility that you may die or be catastrophically injured. Each participant voluntarily and knowingly accepts and assumes all risks." The mandatory waiver gets more precise in the fine print, enumerating 14 ways a person could end up in the hospital as a direct result of their participation in the event. The list includes drowning, near drowning, which apparently needed to be specified, sprains, strains, fractures, burns, hypothermia, animal bites, poisoning, heart attacks, contact with fecal-contaminated water, permanent paralysis, and, yes, that run-of-the-mill catch-all, death. The obstacle course race, or OCR for people in the know, industry, started as a single intense mud run in England in 1987. It went mostly unnoticed in the world until 2009, when the idea of putting rope nets, barrier walls, ice patches, and electrified wires on a race course crossed the Atlantic and set up shop in North America. Today, OCRs reap a reliable $326 million every year from entrance fees and sponsor deals. The Spartan Race features a partnership with Reebok and a production deal with a reality TV show, but it's hardly the only game in town. Other races include Tough Mudder, Warrior Dash, Battle Frog, Strong Viking, Civilian Military Combine, and a seemingly endless list of spin-offs, competitors, and pretenders to the OCR throne. All of them share one thing in common, though. Together, they've managed to persuade tens of millions of people that suffering across potentially life-threatening obstacles is a great way to spend a weekend. And, as the holder of bib number 2182, I am hardly one to pass judgment. The OCR industry is the fastest growing sport in the United States. It has roots in marathons, Ironman, and trail racing, but the bar to entry, or at least participating and earning a medal or t-shirt with the word finisher on it, is far lower. At least 54 million Americans call themselves runners, which makes it the second most popular fitness activity next to walking. That fact, pulled from a report by the Physical Activity Council, seems to suggest that the remaining 208 million Americans have truly sorry workout regimens, and probably helps explain why so many people in this country complain about their ever-expanding waistlines. Footnote. Quality studies of the general exercise habits of Americans are kind of hit or miss, and finding a convincing figure can be tricky. For instance, according to a study by the Breakaway Research Group, 100 million Americans rode a bicycle at least once last year. Whether that makes them bikers or whether the runners identified in the other study cited here qualify for that designation if they went on one or more runs in the previous year is a judgment call that you will have to make for yourself. In 2009, roughly 120,000 people lined up at 11 obstacle course races run by a company called Warrior Dash. Tough Mudder started in Pennsylvania a year later. By 2014, 3.4 million people were willing to shell out entry fees between $100 and $200 to abuse their bodies on whatever challenges organizers threw at them. That the financial barrier is so high probably also reflects the racial and sociological disparities in the country at large, as well as in social media, through which most OCR participants reveal themselves to be young, white, and apparently possessed of some disposable income. Indeed, much of the trend has been fed by smart social media campaigns. Photographers posted at every major obstacle at the Spartan race take tens of thousands of time-stamped pictures, often tagged to the same microchip that racers wear to keep track of their times. The pictures are free to use, which helps explain why just hours after a given race, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other channels explode with pictures of mud-covered friends vaulting over flames, enduring tear gas clouds, or crawling on all fours through beds of snow. The appeal of temporary suffering attracts new racers and weekend warriors to the field of obstacle course race glory. With the exception of elementary school romps over jungle gyms, I have no experience with this sort of thing. This is going to be my first OCR, and thus it is my chance to discover what all the fuss is about. It seems to me that people who are up for running through mud must have a similar disregard for comfort as those who don't mind plunging into a tub full of ice. An obstacle course race also speaks to different mindsets around fitness in general. Exercise doesn't have to mean plunging away on repetitions on scientifically calibrated weight machines or running increasingly long distances on endless miles of roadways. OCRs favor sports dilettantes, for whom fitness means being skilled at all sorts of different athletic challenges, as opposed to being a specialist in any one activity. Part of the allure also harks back to a time that many of us spent playing as children, when climbing up a rope or crawling through a discarded tire was about as much fun as you could pack into a day. And, in a way, this brings me back to the waiver. At first glance, it's hard to tell how much the waiver is there for the entertainment of participants, part of the bragging rights that anyone might claim after crawling under barbed wire, or whether it is actually here to disclose the very real possibility of death and dismemberment. For me, and probably most of the people lined up in the morning heats, it's both. The threat is part of the allure. It is as if those of us who are lucky, skilled, or just tough enough to make it to the finish line do so knowing that someone else might not. Every obstacle on every course breaks down into two basic challenges, the physical and the psychological. Carrying an 8-gallon bucket of dirt up a hill after a 5-mile run might leave your arms aching the next day, but there's no moment when you fear for your life. Other challenges, however, stoke real fear. With races employing tear gas, ice water, electricity, fire, and dizzying heights, the challenge of getting past them isn't usually physical, but it's instead about breaking past mental barriers. The challenge is overcoming your natural instinct to curl up into a ball and wish for home. The popularity of these sorts of obstacles is, in part, the visual appeal. And they are especially striking in the photos on social networks after the race. It just makes you a little more badass at the end of the day if you can brag that you know what it feels like to breathe tear gas. In the era of an all-volunteer army, obstacle course races are about as close to a military-style rite of passage as any of us are likely to experience. This is perhaps why so many OCRs borrow their names from military terminology and from warriors long past. Casualties aside, a lot of people want a chance to test their mettle in a way that could plausibly kill them. There are at least a few studies that attempt to put numbers on the likelihood of things mentioned in the legalese actually happening. One, published in the Journal of the American College of Sports Medicine, examined several Tough Mudder events in 2013 and found that 37 people out of every 1,000 ended up in the hospital on race day. There were injuries to the legs and joints, muscle tears and broken bones. While minor injuries were almost routine on these courses, actual fatalities were still rather low. After consulting experts on the business and a deft search of the internet, I am able to identify 4 deaths across the entire industry, which claimed to have 5.6 million participants in 2015. By contrast, skiing, which boasts 11 million downhillers, kills 40 Americans a year on average. So, yes, the races do indeed carry risks, but they're not extraordinary ones. Injuries are a different matter. A case study in the Annals of Emergency Medicine surveyed one emergency room that was unexpectedly inundated by casualties. One young racer complained of chest pain after 13 consecutive electrical shocks, and a handful of contenders ended up in the emergency room incoherent from pain or exhaustion. One 31-year-old man may have suffered a seizure or stroke and was completely unable to move his right side after completing 20 out of 22 obstacles. On a more intimate level, one that I have to admit most people probably aren't actively worrying over, there's something profound about facing down a situation that might trigger the fight or flight response. Be it a cloud of tear gas, a live wire, or the view from the top of some obscenely imposing jump into cold water, when the brain recognizes what it believes to be a legitimate threat, the sympathetic nervous system kicks into action. The brain's emergency signals will tell the adrenal gland to trigger a cascade of hormonal responses and release the neurotransmitters norepinephrine and epinephrine into the bloodstream. The heart rate goes up, often thumping audibly in the ears. Digestion stops, the pupils dilate, and in extreme circumstances, bladder control could be lost. That all sounds bad. But the high you get from adrenaline is total. The world shifts sharply into focus. Time seems to slow down, and your reactions quicken to a razor's edge. For the time that all that feel-good juice pumps through your bloodstream, you are in such a heightened state of alertness that you feel superhuman. More often than not, you stop thinking altogether, reducing the higher mental functions to the bare tools you need to survive in a given moment. Your body might be so focused on the task at hand that you don't even form coherent memories. But none of that matters. It's addictive, and it's awesome. And it only happens when your body switches into survival mode. Adrenaline, though, doesn't provide an enduring high. Eventually, the feeling of exultation descends into grogginess and fatigue. But the surge is so fundamentally mammalian that it is etched indelibly into our evolutionary past. From the perspective of someone who is trying to use the environment to trigger autonomic responses, OCRs represent a potentially potent tool that a cognizant athlete could use to train their fight or flight response, and in doing so, strengthen their sympathetic nervous system. The obstacles create a sort of safe stimulus to trigger some sort of neural response in the body. If you know what's coming, then a strong stimulus is also an opportunity to train yourself to resist and control potentially beneficial hormonal releases. In this sense, fear of a scary but non-lethal obstacle works the same way that the Wim Hof method tricks the body by hypersaturating the blood with oxygen and blowing off CO2, so that the mind loses track of its preset responses for gasping. The sweet spot at an OCR would be finding a challenge where you are so overcome by an animal impulse for survival that you lose track of who you are in the moment and simply respond to the environment that you're in. If you could condition that release, then it stands to reason that over time, your adrenal response could be made to cave to your will. Yet, for the vast majority of people on the course today, there is a simpler reason to love obstacle course racing. Most sporting events in America are competitions with clear winners and losers. One team overcomes another, or a super athlete dominates a field. Today's OCR event is different. Outside of a few elite competitors, OCRs aren't about beating the guy next to you as much as they are about overcoming whatever the course throws at you. In other words, I didn't come to win. I, like millions of other contenders, came to finish. A few minutes past noon, I arrive at the starting line, where a man with a microphone and army camo shorts urges would-be Spartans to crowd together in a bullpen in front of an inflatable race gate. To get there, 100 of us have to surmount our first obstacle, a 4-foot wall made of plywood and 2x4s. It's just a taste of what is to come. "When I ask you who you are, you yell back, 'I am a Spartan,'" he calls into his microphone. It is the 50th heat of the day, but the MC doesn't appear tired of the routine. His lips peel back into a menacing grin as he asks his question. And once we call back, he starts chanting the Spartan war cry. "Aru! Aru! Aru!" The Greek version of the Marine Corps' oorah. My wife rolls her eyes at the regalia and asks me to promise that I won't play along. Even though the obstacle course race industry is reasonably gender balanced with 4 women entering for every 6 men, the overall feeling of most races brims with machismo. I aru anyway. We are Spartans, after all. Then there's a puff of smoke from a firework and the slow rumbling of a legion of would-be Spartans in spandex running shorts, headbands, and nervous energy as it pushes forward up a green grass slope that serves as a ski hill in the winter months. My wife and I bring up the middle. For the first 100 yards or so, the stampede moves like it is shot out of a cannon. But the grade of the hill takes a steeper turn, and the crowd slows to a crawl. For a 6-mile race called a sprint, it's hard for me to tell if this is just pacing in anticipation of some really grueling obstacles that the pack leader knows about all too well, or if instead it is a sign that none of us in this heat are actually extreme athletes. The course weaves in and out of an alpine landscape, and the moment the mountain levels off, the trail crashes into a shallow and slightly chilly pond. We dive in headfirst, then surge forward out of the muck until we come to a giant pile of snow that has been transported here from higher up on the mountain. This part of the course makes us crawl beneath barbed wire, and we scrape our knees on jagged edges of packed ice. Blood drips down my legs. The sight of the superficial wound invigorates me for more. I get up and begin a dash downhill, where there are a series of variously tall walls to leap or scramble over. By mile 5, I am not nearly as spent as I'd hoped to be. I'm beginning to wonder if I should have signed up for the alternate, a 16-mile course called the Beast, that adds more obstacles and another few thousand feet of elevation gain. But the race isn't over. We jog forward with 1,000 other people until the course intersects in an area where very tired-looking contenders who are on the final leg of the Beast meet us. They've done an additional 10 miles more than we have, and look the part. Their faces are drawn and white with exhaustion, and their paces are measurably slower than us sprinters. I'm a little jealous. The courses join in front of an 8-foot boundary wall that is now a choke point for about 50 participants waiting their turn for a chance to hop over. Directly in front of me is a platoon of off-duty soldiers who have come up from a base near Denver. I watch as one shaven-headed lad with acne, no shirt, and blood streaming down his shins from an earlier fall runs full bore at the wall and jumps. His hands grasp the black-painted 2x4 at the top, and his near-naked body slams against the barrier. He manages to half-pull himself up before he runs out of juice and sinks to the ground. He looks down at his feet, and runs back to the line, all the while apologizing to his company. "Sarge will never forgive me if I don't get over this," he says, determined to keep at it or die trying. So I watch and wait as he charges and faceplants into the plywood for a second time. On his third attempt, his buddy gives him a helping push over. I hear him crash down on the other side, no doubt happy to be done with this part. Unlike traditional races, obstacle courses don't favor specialists. The variety of challenges play to different strengths, so very few participants excel at everything. The lean build of an ultrarunner may help with the steep hill, but doesn't play favorably with a 20-foot rope climb that requires upper body strength. Fear of heights could stymie someone at the top of a wall, while a great jumper might have too much muscle weight to really compete with someone who trains for marathons. In this sense, obstacle course races bring out the best and worst in an athlete's training. The people who make it into the elite tier are well-rounded, but they are not likely to excel in traditional pro sports. No doubt, the soldier who barely made it over the wall will crush the next challenge just around the corner. After my wife disappears on the other side of the bulwark, I make a short sprint and, despite my pendulous calf muscles and 6'2" frame, easily grab the top of the barrier that had stymied the soldier. Still flush with momentum, I sling my foot sideways to latch to the top of the wall and begin to haul the rest of my body over. Then, somewhere in the middle of that movement, I feel a barely audible pop in the vicinity of my pelvis. When my feet make contact with the soft ground on the other side, spears of shooting pain course directly into my brain. I walk a few steps and stop in my tracks. My wife runs in place next to me and gives me a worried look. I press my hand into the part of my groin where the ball head of my femur attaches to the hip socket. I'm pretty sure that something isn't quite right. But I'm not ready to hang up my racing laurels either. In the obstacle course world, a DNF for did not finish is a mark of shame. So, rather than submit to the pain, I limp forward a few more paces and grit my teeth. I can do this, I tell myself, figuring that if I just keep moving, that the joint won't have an immediate excuse to stiffen. My wife and I inch gingerly up the hill at a slow jog until we pass a woman in pigtails, a neon green headband, yoga pants, and a compression bandage wrapped tightly around her ankle. She is moving at a crawl, but she's still moving. I ask her what happened. "I strained it back there," she replies through a grimace, adding, "but I'm going to finish this. There is no way I'm going to be carried off the field." I offer to help, but she wants none of it. The course opens up again a few dozen feet later, and now I can see hundreds of people on a long, straight stretch. At least a quarter of them jerk and scowl as they favor one limb or another. Pain is everywhere. And in a way, seeing all of that suffering is part of the plan in the first place. No one starts out wanting to get hurt, but even though we don't like it, we all share the experience together. A handful of obstacles later, I find myself near the end of the race, climbing a 20-foot rope hand over hand above a muddy pool of ice water. The goal is to ring a cowbell at the top. But 3/4 of the way up, I look down. It's a mistake. The world seems to go off kilter, and I imagine what would happen if I let go and fell backward, maybe smacking my head and sinking below the opaque surface. Though I still have strength left, the vision of falling makes me pause. I slink down the rope, defeated not by my muscle, but by my mind. The punishment for not completing an obstacle at the Spartan race is 30 burpees, so I get down in the mud nearby and do my penance. Put off by the failure, I slog on towards the last obstacle, a wall of fire. There is no challenge to speak of, Just a small hop through a flame. It's over in a flash. I end the race, triumphant. Across the finish line are more canned photos, a medal that certifies me as a bona fide obstacle course race finisher, and an invitation to visit the beer hall with anyone else who has just gotten off the course. Muddied and bruised, my wife and I find an encampment of hoses, and we spray each other down with ice-cold water, a final shock to the nervous system. I am tired, but not exhausted, amped up, but not exhilarated, and at least part of me still wants something more. In appealing to the masses, the race promises anyone a chance to meet their limits, which maybe I did at the top of the rope with an unrung cowbell, but no challenge pushed me to a razor's edge, where my mind shut off and the reflexes of my lizard brain took over. I'd hoped to corner my inner animal by finding the very limit of my endurance. I will carry the pelvic injury with me for a matter of days, but experiencing an injury was never the point. I wanted to be scared and exhilarated all at once. But maybe I'd just chosen the wrong event. It wasn't necessarily the Spartan Race's fault that I hadn't opted for the longer course. There are hundreds of obstacle course races every year that might yet leave me even more burned, battered, and bruised in the end. I've already received an invitation from a friend who is making a film about obstacle course races to visit a course in England in the next winter that is reputed to be the most brutal of them all. It's an appealing opportunity, and one that I plan to take him up on. However, I suspect that before I get there, I need to find another way to capture that moment of primal awareness that I'm looking for. I need a different way to break into the deepest recesses of my brain. And so I decide that I need to find someone whose pursuit of adrenal bliss puts him in constant contact with his own mortality. A man who has no liability waiver to serve up. Chapter 6: Art of the Crash. On August 7th, 2000, on a shallow reef off of the coast of Tahiti named Tihapu, or Place of Skulls in the local tongue, surfing legend Laird Hamilton clung to a tow line behind a jet ski piloted by his friend Derek Dorner. The swells that day were slow, lumbering giants that seemed to drag the full weight of the South Pacific Ocean with them. The waves at Tiapu Reef form deep in an endless abyss inside an oceanic trench before rocketing upward to a point as shallow as 20 inches below the surface. The sudden change in depth funnels the water in such a way that not only results in truly monstrous waves, but a regular, semicircular presentation with an almost perfect hollow break. It's the sort of ideal spot that surfers have always dreamed of exploring. But there was no practical way to paddle over the monsters without risking life and limb. Hamilton's idea was to circumvent the most obvious obstacle by strapping his feet to a surfboard and then asking a friend to tow him out on the wave behind a jet ski. Until this point, no one had ever attempted anything like it. Nervous, Dorner and Hamilton watched the ocean focus its power on one particularly imposing swell. Dorner gunned the engine and brought Hamilton screaming to the precipice of the rising water. As it began to curl, Dorner had second thoughts. He wanted to turn back, to tell Hamilton to abort. The water was just too big. The swell they were cresting wasn't just any wave, it was more like a tsunami. But when Dorner looked back for his partner, Hamilton was gone. After letting go of the tow line, Hamilton felt the immense power of the water below him, and his board sucked backward into the vortex of fluid that seemed to twist the very logic of gravity. The upward force of the water was so strong that he had to steady himself by dipping his hand into the water on the front side of the board, a movement that most surfers who fear falling over the leading edge of their boards find antithetical to balance. Yet, to keep upright, Hamilton had to account for the unexpected current. As the wave crashed around him, a videographer in the water captured his image as he disappeared into the collapsing tube. Several agonizing seconds passed. Dorner's heart sank as he imagined Hamilton's battered body torn apart by the crushing water. He was sure that this blur of white water and deadly seafoam had just ended his friend's life. Then, inexplicably, Hamilton shot out of the pipe intact, jubilant, and humbled. With a face of at least 40 feet high and more than 100 meters long, it was the heaviest wave that had ever been ridden, estimated at about 30,000 tons. Papers dubbed it the Millennium Wave. Surfer magazine ran a photo of Hamilton crouched low on his board with a headline so flabbergasted that the editor couldn't even muster capital letters, just the words, "Oh my God." The video of the ride ushered in a new era of tow surfing. The YouTube video has racked up 1.1 million views, while a more recent video of another surfer on the same wave drew 26 million sets of eyes. It's the sort of feat that only the very best watermen can even attempt, one where only the lucky survive. Since 2000, at least five surfers have died trying to replicate Hamilton's effort. Despite all of this, I've never heard of Hamilton until I begin looking deeper into the practical applications of the Wim Hof method. After the Spartan race, I want to meet a person whose connection to the natural world allows him to accomplish feats that are at such a grand scale that they are superhuman. I call Scott Canale, a journalist and filmmaker outside of San Francisco, who has covered obstacle course racing and extreme sports for years. I tell him about my predicament, and he can't help from laughing at me over the phone. "You mean you don't know Laird Hamilton? Literally one of the best surfers of all time does Wim Hof's breathing every single day," he says, chiding me for my ignorance. "Hang on, I'll put you in touch. He doesn't use email, so you're going to have to call." Over the next few days, I read up on Hamilton's career. I call buddies who spend every opportunity on California's endless beaches. They can't help but relay their own chance encounters with him. One of them, a creative executive at an ad agency in LA, remembers sitting on the sand while eyeballing Hamilton as he shot the pier, riding a wave through the narrow confines of barnacle-encrusted support pillars where 1 inch of miscalculation would mean being caught between 50 tons of water and an implacable piling. Another friend remembers seeing someone on a stand-up paddleboard who was just a speck on the horizon, but moving at an incomprehensibly fast pace. "It could only have been Laird," he tells me. The stories of Hamilton only grow with each telling. It is as if Hamilton isn't a person, but a folk hero on the order of Paul Bunyan. He is an adventurer who matches the likes of the great polar explorer Ernest Shackleton, or George Mallory, the first man to attempt to summit Everest. At the same time, Hamilton is remarkably accessible. Once I manage to get him on the phone, I merely mention my interest in Wim Hof, and any airs that might have been stewing vanish. Hamilton splits his time between homes in Hawaii and on the Southern California coast in Malibu. It so happens that he's developed a training program based in part on Wim's breathing techniques. He suggests that I book the next ticket I can find to come out to see him. So, a few weeks later, I hop a plane to Los Angeles during one of the most severe droughts ever to blanket the region. The heat wave comes on the back of the hot Santa Ana winds that blow in from Mexico. Just 10 minutes after arriving, the sweltering heat is enough to leave me drenched in sweat. I stay with a friend of mine in Long Beach, which is on the far southern rim of Los Angeles County. The drive to the most northern reaches of Malibu will take me clear up the coast, across the bustling center of the metropolis, and into the rustic beaches of the north. I am supposed to show up for the beginning of the workout at around 8 o'clock in the morning. But even though I make an early start getting behind the wheel of a subcompact rented Nissan before 6 a.m., I still find myself snarled in the city's impenetrable gridlock. As I inch up the 405's expanse of asphalt, I consult my phone for any hope of a shortcut. It suggests a 20-minute detour into equally impregnable city streets before dumping me back out on the same highway just a few blocks ahead of where I had just been. If I'd consulted a map, I would have known that it was a hopeless effort to begin with. Unlike the ancestral wave pilots of the South Pacific, or even myself before the year 2000, I still have no innate sense of direction. It is well after 9 before I show up in Malibu. From the street, Hamilton's place is disguised by a concrete wall and a dull gray iron gate. But the curb overflows with luxury automobiles, a dead giveaway that behind this barrier, Hollywood's glitterati meet for secret training sessions. I squeeze my rental between a Porsche and a Bentley. I approach on foot, and as I get closer, I can make out the sounds of splashing water and tribal music. I peek through a section of iron mesh and wave at a man in a swim cap for the gate code. He yells back 4 digits and I let myself in. It's only when I get a little closer that I realize that the square-jawed gentleman is actor John C. McGinley, a regular on the medical sitcom Scrubs, a veteran of the Oliver Stone film Platoon, and 100 other movies and TV shows. Somewhere in the pool, Orlando Bloom is swimming underwater laps while carrying 2 35-pound weights. It's hard to make sense of exactly what all this means. As it turns out, Hamilton owns one of the largest private outdoor pools in Southern California, which says quite a bit considering how access to water in Los Angeles is as much a status symbol as it is an occasional necessity to seeking relief from the summer heat. It's 12 feet deep in order to facilitate the underwater exercise routines he's been experimenting with. The boot camp that Hamilton runs, what he calls XPT, which stands for Extreme Pool Training or, depending who you ask, also Exploration Performance Training, is the most exclusive workout in the city. Here is where the music producer Rick Rubin, the co-founder of Def Jam Records and the producer behind the hit albums by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Beastie Boys, and Lady Gaga, lost 130 pounds with a combination of ice baths and outdoor recreation. It is where some founders of CrossFit explore new routines, and most important, it's where Hamilton spends his off-season before chasing big waves throughout the winter. At 6'2" and with a sandy shock of blonde hair that sweeps across his forehead, Laird Hamilton has the rugged good looks that betray how easy it was for him to make a living as a model in his teen years. Now, in his early 50s, his body remains a solid wall of muscle. It's important to have an off-season, Hamilton tells me once I make it down to the pool deck and notice the conspicuous lack of surfing gear lying around. It lets me anticipate what's to come. Rather than spend a lot of time asking him questions, Hamilton tells me to just get in the water and get a feel for it myself. Footnote: the underwater exercises described here are inherently dangerous and should never be undertaken without appropriate experience, training, fitness level, doctor approval, and supervision. He wants to put me through a couple of his introductory routines, so I dive in with a mask on and start treading water. Hamilton grabs 2 25-pound weights, places them on the rim of the pool, and then jumps in next to me. Using only hand signals, he directs me to watch his movements, and, without more explanation, he grabs both weights off of the deck and sinks quickly to the bottom. Landing in an underwater squat, he raises the 2 dumbbells over his head and uses his coiled legs to blast off of the ground, sending his body rocketing toward the surface in a reverse dive. To add power to the movement, he strokes downward with the 50 added pounds of lead, using them like makeshift fins. His head breaks out of the surface just long enough for him to take a giant breath of air before sinking again to the bottom. This is one rep of potentially dozens. The underwater power jumps are supposed to roll out one after another, just like the push-ups after Hoff's breathing exercises. Once he's muscled through 10 repetitions, he gives me a smile and places the metal weights on the pool deck. "The trick is in the jump," he says. "You won't get very much power in the stroke when you're holding the weights." And with that, I grab the same set of dumbbells and let them carry me into the depths. At first, the movement is not completely intuitive. It's strange to move underwater and not be swimming, but it's also impossible to float while carrying so many extra pounds. I look up through the blue waters and see Orlando Bloom swim a lap while carrying what looks like a 40-pound weight close to his chest. He is skimming along the surface using only his legs, with the weight held firmly in both hands. It's a move that they call an ammo box, and I am doing my best not to be starstruck while weighted down on the pool floor. So I focus on imitating Hamilton's form and plant my feet firmly on the ground, crouch into a squat, and launch myself upward while letting my arms fall to my side in a rough imitation of what I'd just seen Hamilton do. I have enough force to clear the surface and just enough time to gasp for air before the weight drags me back down. The first few reps aren't too bad. I find a rhythm when I bob to the surface, take a gulp of air, and sink back down. But every time I hit the apogee of the movement, I suck in just slightly less air than what I've used. I'm running on a deficit. After 5 reps, I begin to struggle. I'm not sure I have the power to reach the surface with the lead in my hands, so I gather myself by walking along the floor of the pool to its concrete edge. I look up through the mask and I figure that I can make one last jump. I jump, push the weights above my head, and have just enough power to heave them up and set them on the deck. I catch my breath while holding on to the edge and look down into the depths at the hubbub of activity. John McGinley is walking back and forth underwater with a single 50-pound dumbbell clutched in both arms, only coming up for air after he's done walking 2 lateral laps. Over the next couple hours, Hamilton runs me through a half dozen other exercises. One is called the seahorse, in which I cinch 30 pounds of iron between my legs and try to remain in a seated position while also awkwardly attempting to perform an underwater lap with a sort of wing-like breaststroke. There is an exercise sort of like the ammo box that Bloom had been doing, but with a weight so heavy that there is no chance of staying on the surface. Instead, the lap becomes a sort of descending line to 12 feet down on the other side of the pool. The exercise ends with a power jump back to the surface, and then a return lateral lap with the same diagonal descent. There are also just simple underwater laps, in which I try to do as many lengths as possible on a single breath, or occasionally just one gulp of air on either side. The exercise starts off reasonably easy, but gets progressively harder.